Hello, I'm Emily Sage. I'm an instructor for Exhibition Strategies and Museum Studies at Johns Hopkins University. I'm speaking today with Darcy Foreman, an exhibit developer who has been the creative force behind many powerful exhibitions at museums, including the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, the Oakland Museum of California, the Exploratorium, the Levine Museum of the New South, and the Bay Area Discovery Museum, to name a few. Today we'll be talking about Remember the Children, Daniel's Story, an exhibit at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, originally installed in 1993 as a temporary exhibition that has stood the test of time as a permanent exhibition. The target age group for this exhibition was 9 to 13-year-olds. Hi, Darcy.
How are you?
Okay, Emily. Good to see you.
You too.
So, Darcy, this exhibit tells the story of the Holocaust through the point of view of a young boy named Daniel. Can you tell us a bit about the process of deciding from whose point of view the story should be told and why?
Yes, the reason, well, we wanted it to be told through one child's eyes, and it had to be a boy, and his name didn't have to be Daniel, but it's a good, solid biblical name. And the reason is because if we wanted him to survive the Holocaust, and the only people who survived the Holocaust were those who went to concentration camps very late in the war. So backing up, he had to be about six when Hitler came to power. He had to be a boy so he was strong and could work. His father was a hero in World War I, so that kept the family from getting persecuted earlier in the war. There were all kinds of very specific people who survived the Holocaust. They were strong, they were healthy, they could work in slave labor conditions, and were strong enough to be alive when the camps were liberated.
Right. Was there any discussion or debate on your development team on whether Daniel should be based on a real person specifically, or that he should be sort of a generalized version of somebody?
There was, as you can imagine, a lot of discussion, and there are tons of children's diaries that survived the war. We know Anne Frank, and there's a whole book of French children's diaries from that time. There wasn't one that anybody knew of that would fit the specifications of a child that would survive, or then it would be too specific, and we wanted him to be of a secular Jewish background, middle class. In order to do it the way we decided, through his eyes, we had to put a lot of parameters on him that couldn't have probably fit one real person. So that was the decision.
Do you think that visitors, I know it states that at the beginning of the exhibition, but doing evaluation or seeing what visitors write at the end of the exhibition, do you think that visitors, especially children, know whether he's a real person or not, or that it even matters?
I think that probably there's confusion. I think that's a very good question to ask the museum. And one of the people on our team is still there, Lauriston Marshall. So that would be a good question for your students to pursue, because to my knowledge, there's not been formal evaluation, even though we did a traveling version. And the way kids write the postcards at the end, often it's to Daniel or to his family. You know, they're old enough to probably know that
right.
He, because of the dates, that he's not living. But was he real? I don't know. And I think that's a dilemma.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about strategies and symbolic aspects to the design that were used to intentionally create empathy or to create tension or drama or those kind of feelings that would really connect, especially children, to this story and at the end feel like they had a relationship to someone like Daniel.
So in thinking about telling it through one child's eyes and making all these decisions about what his life would have been like, we decided to try to not only say what was going on at those periods in history, if at all, only really tangentially, like a message on the radio or a map that he drew in school, putting Germany in the center so it would be maybe clear from the map that this was Germany. It was all very subtle decisions. It was more about creating an emotional relationship with Daniel and trying to have you be in his place, whether you're a kid or an adult, that you are experiencing what he experienced. And so we started in the entrance is very evocative, expressionistic colors, and the window metaphor we started with. And then there's a film in the beginning where he's talking to you, so we had to find a young person to be Daniel's voice, and he's giving you some background history and in this dark space. So right away, trying to put people in his place and then walk down the street, and it goes from happy normal life and his toys and his mother baking cookies with his sister in the kitchen, and it's just a tiny peek through, we called it 2.5D, but there's a sound of a mother and daughter or a mother and little girl laughing and talking about the cookies, and so all the way throughout trying to just recreate these environments that you could put yourself in as his life got more restricted and deteriorated. Colors got darker. It went from realistic wallpaper to expressionistic murals. All the way through, it taking you on a visual and experiential and immersive journey.
So do you think any of those cues that you just described, that do they help visitors connect at all to the rest of the story and the rest of the museum, because it's so disparate in design and so different from how the rest of the museum is laid out and how it makes you feel?
I think personally that, well, we didn't expect it to last this long. It was designed to be a 5-year temporary exhibition, and 30 years on, it's kind of amazing that it even still exists, and it's been refurbished. And I think the reason, for me, the reason it still exists and what I hear from people is because it is so different than the rest of the museum. The stories told and the way it's presented in the rest of the museum is encyclopedic, archival, also very moving in many places, but it was important to get all the facts in. It was important that it serves as an archive to commemorate and mark this history and document it for future generations. And the goal of all of the museum is so that Holocaust doesn't happen again, which we know hasn't worked, but it's, I think Daniel's story is a complement, a different way into it, and also it's on the first floor, you don't have to wait for tickets, it's a more accessible.
Right.
So I think it's a complement to the rest of the museum.
When you walk through Daniel's story, it is a very linear approach, right? It's not an open room with a bunch of different stations you can go to learn things. So was that linear approach? It was obviously intentional, but how solidified was that in your development process from early on, or was it something you arrived at as you were developing the story?
It was early on. It was in order, it's so incomprehensible what happened to the Jews and other persecuted people under the Nazi regime, that it seemed important, it is important to create the ideal of normalcy that existed before. And especially for an American audience, our life here as Jews is really very similar to the secular assimilated life that existed. It exists now, I think, to some degree. There's always anti-Semitism, but back then, Jews were in every level of government and leadership, and I think it's why nobody could believe it would get, you know, each step of restrictive rules, well, couldn't get worse than that, you know. So I think we wanted to build that slowly, as in a small space, but as slowly as we could to show that incremental life. And then another design decision was to use mid-century modern furniture, which came from the Bauhaus, came from Germany, and an assimilated middle-class family might have actually had their house furnished in a way that today looks like IKEA, and so kids today could even maybe relate to it. So that was all very conscious.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Because I, you know, you don't know what that process is like if you're not a part of it. You only see the end result. So
right. I just can't even tell your class how every single decision, I mean, I think it's true with anything that's designed. It takes a lot of planning and intention and understanding of the audience. And every little detail in there was very intentional.
Well, and speaking of decisions, in this course, we focus a lot on collaboration, and our students are required to work in teams to develop their exhibition, which of course requires team decision making. As you know, collaboration can be challenging. Can you relate some of your experiences you had with collaboration during the development process, and either how it hindered or how it helped the design and the visitor experience at the end of the day?
I think collaboration is key to creating an exhibition or probably any large multi-team project. If you want to reach a large audience, if you want to not just have it be from one person's vision, then you have to collaborate and have other points of view. In this case, I had to put my team together to apply for the project. It was a National Park Service request for proposal, and the two people that I brought in, I had worked before and knew we were very collaborative and had complementary skills, Kathy McLean and John Kyoto. And Kathy was brought in as a writer and John as the design, technical designer. I'm the lead designer, and we worked and even gave credit equally, and even with the graphic designer that we brought in a little bit later. It was over a year of meeting in DC. I can't remember how many meetings, but all of us would, so I had to put that into my proposal so there'd be enough money. We'd go to DC and meet with the three people, and then that grew one other person who was the researcher of the children's diaries. But we had this team that met frequently enough, and the building was being built. We were in this terrible office building, you know, on L or something. And so how do you foster creativity in this difficult situation, traveling across the country, meeting under fluorescent lights? And the in-house team was led by this very strong woman who really wasn't as collaborative as we were. So we just kept trying to demonstrate our way of working together. So it wasn't like from a rule book, it was just how we worked together. And it was messy, and they got into it. And I think that John and Kathy and I value that messiness and understand the value of it. And so there'd be lots of arguments and lots of debates, lots of disagreement, that in the end, the lead person at the museum had to make the final call. And often we'd have to jump through hoops to prove our ideas to her and communicate our ideas well. So that's always the case on every project, though. Mm-hmm. As you know, yep. There's always a client, and even if you're in-house, there's the director. And another very important thing that I always establish is the approvals process and the stages for approval. And so there has to be an end and decision-making point, and then you make your best choice.
Right. Were there parts of this story that your team decided were unexhibitable, that you really couldn't display in this setting for this age group? And what were they, and were they specific to this age group for that decision?
Yes, absolutely. And in many exhibits, and including upstairs in the main museum, there are very difficult images and artifacts, and they're put in a way that little kids can't see them. Since this was for young people, but not that young. That was initially they wanted the exhibit. They said it was supposed to be for K through 12. Mm-hmm. And that was another thing that when I went to the first interview, I said, it can't be, you must do evaluation, and it can't be, it's just too broad to be powerful. And so through a lot of work with survivors and child development psychologists and discussion and learning, we chose that junior high level, old enough to know about death and comprehend certain conceptual ideas, but we didn't want to really show Nazis. We didn't want to, we chose not. There's one SS officer in a little black and white picture behind a window. That was a very conscious decision. Not only did we not want to show anything brutal and killing and violence, there's broken glass. There's the picture of the painting of the mural of the temple burning in Kristallnacht. There's evidence of violence and destruction, but nothing explicit. So you see loss. And then the other big decision was that we take you to the outside entrance of Auschwitz. You don't go in the concentration camp. So that was a very important decision.
How would you describe the evolution of your approach to development from your time working on Daniel's story to more recent projects such as the Levine Museum of the New South? Have you changed how you approach either collaboration or development, or things you've learned along the way that you think are really critical that you always carry with you?
By the time I did Daniel's story, I'd already been doing exhibits for, I think, 17 years or almost 20 years. And my basic approach, certain things haven't changed that much. The important things to me are the designers at the table at the very beginning. You need enough time and money to spend on concept planning, and you need to bring in stakeholders to test your ideas and be able to change and have an iterative process so it grows. You can have an idea of what you want to do, but if you're really doing this iterative process, you might see that something isn't working, and so you have to be flexible to change your mind so that when you're having these arguments, there's a realization that you might have to give up on some wonderful idea that you had. I started out as an art teacher, and my degree's in education, and so I think my approach to thinking about visitors and who it's for has always driven me, so that really hasn't changed that much. It's not so much about what's the topic, what it's about, but it's like, why should anyone care about it? And getting at that with the teams I work with. And I, as a freelancer, I was in-house for a long time, and so then I started freelancing. Every museum's different, and the Levine, so I've learned new things as I've probably gotten older. Also teaching. I taught at JFK. I taught exhibition planning and design. So that helped me learn and understand why we do certain things and why we make choices and be more philosophical about it. The biggest change has come with working, and I think this is because of the Levine, really, working with the community in planning and bringing the people who are involved in the story into the process, and then creating the exhibition, especially there. But now everywhere, it's really affected my approach that exhibitions are really only valuable as catalysts for programs and dialogue. And so at the Levine, the three projects I did, we actually created space in the exhibition so that groups could come through and have a place to sit and talk and discuss the issues. Those were all issue-based projects. So I think that's the biggest change, is working with the community and bringing in Brad Larson. Mm-hmm. So all my projects there, I brought Brad into the first one, and then they kept using him. And his technology has evolved over the years, so we've always had story booths in the projects. And then the last one, the Latino project, he has a story kiosk, and so we could take it out to the community, and they created like a front porch that could travel around, and it's in the South, you know, and gather stories, use those in the exhibitions, put them on TV, on public television, you know, a lot of back and forth to try to bring people into it.
Did you find that kind of community input changed the approach to the exhibit? That Definitely. There was some Absolutely. Significant information that you wouldn't have had without doing that?
Absolutely. There's a project that we didn't actually end up doing, because the director changed at the Levine Museum of the New South, we ended up calling it Reading, Writing, and Race. And we were working with these communities that were involved with this children's book that was written about a black sharecropper family in the South in the 30s. And there's beautiful, like, WPA-style photographs in this book instead of little kids' drawings. It's like a primer. And it's all about, it's written by this white woman who, like, look at the happy parents sitting in their living room listening to the radio, and here's the kids out picking tobacco, and they're having so much fun. You know, it was a different time, and it meant, they meant well. And meeting with the community, meeting with the people who were actually photographed back then, or the relatives who grown, now, of course, grown, it was just crucial to understand how they thought about themselves, how they thought about the book in terms of what we wanted to communicate. So it's always just so important. With the Courage exhibition, which was the first project I did there, was about Brown versus Board of Education, and it was for the anniversary, and we went, I said I'd like to go see where this happened, and we went to, there was a small town that was ended up being the first case, because this reverend stood up with the NAACP about getting equal education, and they burned the church down, and we're in this new, ugly, kind of modern church that had no character. And just by being there, this young granddaughter walked in with her grandmother, all bent over, carrying something. It turned out to be the burnt Bible from the church. That just wouldn't have happened if we hadn't have been there and gone out into the community. So to me, I don't want to work on projects if I can't do that. And especially if you want to work on projects that, where you're hoping to understand or change a situation, you can't do that if you don't bring people in to get it.
So is there anything that you think that students who are just entering the field now should consider when developing exhibits around difficult or sensitive topics? Like, we've touched on community engagement, we've touched on sort of how to create empathy in an exhibit and for a specific target age group to make it effective. Is there anything else you think people should really be considering for what's happening next?
I think that students in creating exhibitions now should really think of them as catalysts for programs and dialogue. It doesn't make any sense to me that a museum spends resources on changing exhibitions 4 or 6 times a year. Keep one up and do more with that one and bring in the community and try to affect change based on whatever you're trying to get people to understand. Or at least build empathy. Representatives of those affected by the social issues should be on the planning team. Very important to who's around the table. You know, you're planning a exhibit about race and there's all white middle-aged women around the table. It's a problem. I think an important lesson for me is taking the time to talk to people and listen and hear the stories and hear not only the people who are maybe victims or affected by a sensitive issue, but also what potential visitors think about what are their misconceptions. And even if you don't have money to hire a firm to do front-end evaluation, you could state your assumptions and then see how people react to them. Find out what are your misconceptions and what are their misconceptions. And then you have the material that you need to present. Something that I think I could say came to me working with the Levine Museum of the New South, because they're an International Sites of Conscience mm-hmm. institution. Is that what that's called? There's an arc of dialogue when you're talking about sensitive topics, and this is written about and important to understand if you're in a facilitated group. And it occurred to me that we could design exhibitions with that kind of arc. And so we tried this with the Latino show called Latinos in the New South, Nuevo Lucian, and start with an icebreaker. Where do you fit in your community? And then build the questions or the prompts that you want visitors to think about, sort of build that. So first they're starting with themselves, and then they might start to think about their neighbors, and then they might start to think about the larger community, whatever the issue is. And then they might, hopefully through the prompts or the interactives or whatever, even the writing, it's building to how would you like to see things in the future. And so you start to see what's happening with the whatever the topic is, but you have this layer of putting yourself in the story. It's not easy because we're just one team trying to figure this out, and there's all different learning styles and all different people coming, but I think if you keep it simple and get to universal emotions and feeling, you know, just the universal human condition, and keep that in mind, you can relate to a lot of people that way.
Thank you for talking with me today. Your work has been inspiring for many people, and I know that you will continue to inspire the next group of people coming through and learning about exhibition design and development. And I really appreciate you sharing this with our students. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. And I feel like I'm talking to your students right now, and it makes me very happy.
Thanks, Darcy.